This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, protests in Inglewood, California, where a young Black man and woman were shot dead by police in their sleep. And who is the greatest danger to peace, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton?
But first, the FBI has issued new guidelines for advising teachers who to look out for in terms of political dissent in the classroom. The FBI guidelines are mainly targeted at Muslims, but according to Michael German, a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, the language could also be used to persecute almost any person or group that a teacher did not like or understand.
That's exactly right. And it's been interesting how this concept, what the federal government is calling countering violent extremism, it used to be called counter-radicalization, has been used not just in the most immediate future since the Obama administration announced this as one of their prime initiatives in counterterrorism in 2011, but long before that as well. That this concept that if there are a few people committing violence in the name of a particular ideology, anyone who shares that ideology becomes the suspect pool that needs to be suppressed, that it's the ideas themselves that are dangerous and need to be suppressed. So if it's easy to pick a particular group that is engaged in violence and authorize this program at them, and the modern CVE or countering violent extremism program is directed primarily at the Muslim community right now, but the conceptual part of it applies to any ideology, and of course in the past has applied to civil rights organizing, anti-war organizing, and many other types of legitimate social advancement in the name of protecting security.
This is an FBI whose cultural, institutional history includes COINTELPRO and all kinds of dastardly deeds directed against whole groups of folks.
Exactly. People might remember the Peter King hearings on radicalization a couple of years ago, but the first congressional hearings on radicalization happened way back in 1917. When the end of World War, there was a concern about Bolshevism and the rise of labor rights, and the fact of a few people committing violence acts, or more violence happening abroad, as in the Russian Revolution, gave the FBI a cause to seek out the ideas of Americans, and they started collecting dossiers on people based on things they wrote or things they said that suggested they might be sympathetic to either communism, socialism, but even things such as labor rights and civil rights became enough to put you on a list and to have the intensive investigative power of the FBI on your back. So this is an old problem that whenever there is a perceived national security crisis, it enables that same type of activity. So unfortunately, we're seeing it again here.
The FBI's educational materials, that is, the materials that they use when they advise teachers what they should be doing in the classroom, specifically mentions anarchist extremists, and it defines such people as folks who rail against large corporations, government organizations, and police agencies. That sounds like a broad swath of the left.
Yeah, it sounds like me. It's interesting how this has developed, because when the Obama administration first started promoting its CVE, counterviolent extremism programming, it was directed solely at the Muslim communities in the United States. And there was some pushback against that. But rather than acknowledge that, yes, this is bad programming, they said, oh, we'll solve that by targeting other groups as well with bad programming. So they started incorporating these other groups, but that's kind of how we have seen this naturally happen in the past. So the clear problem is they're identifying not people who are doing harm or planning to do harm, but rather people who are thinking things the government thinks are dangerous. And they're described in such broad ways that it can incorporate a lot of different types of discussion or writing. And you can imagine in a school environment, particularly with the heightened hysteria around terrorism today, that teachers would be reporting not the average suburban school kid who's talking about their political ideology, but rather the kid who's already marginalized either because of his race or because of his political viewpoint as dangerous simply because they're expressing ideas that the teacher or school administration might object to.
Yes, you're talking about the FBI's warning that teachers should be on the lookout for folks who use code words or unusual language. Unusual language,
right.
That's as culturally laden as one could imagine.
Right. It's interesting how they take a lot of studies about unrelated things like other types of school violence or bullying or, in one case, World Health Organization studies on disadvantaged youth, and then describe those as at-risk communities that need to be observed. So, for instance, the way it quotes the World Health Organization talking about at-risk adolescents include risk factors, which include cultural backgrounds, employment opportunities, availability of health care, societal norms, and socioeconomic status. So again, this is sort of branding the underprivileged communities in the United States as the suspect pools. And that has, number one, it's offensive to me as a former FBI agent and counterterrorism researcher because it's afactual, right? If you look at actual terrorists, they come from every socioeconomic status. Some of them come from extremely wealthy families. So the idea that targeting only the socially and economically disadvantaged would be effective is simply factually incorrect. But it's this odd dynamic where because the government has discriminated against you in the past or your community or people who are in your same social or economic status, that then justifies further discrimination of you. It's this entirely circular reasoning that is hard to square with any type of legitimate government programming.
And since these guidelines come in with the imprimatur of the federal government, it kind of gives a blank check to teachers to make their own judgments.
Absolutely. And because these so-called risk factors or indicators are so broad, you could apply whatever prism you want to them. And unfortunately, I think as human beings, we all harbor some kind of bias. So it's not the person who we agree with who we tend to be suspicious of, but the person we disagree with. And because it focuses so heavily on what it calls extremist propaganda and internet activities as the radicalizing influences that need to be watched, obviously, people who are exploring or expressing alternative viewpoints will be seen as suspicious. And again, this is in an educational environment. We want students to be exploring areas outside their comfort zone, to be struggling with difficult intellectual concepts. So the idea that we would be turning a classroom into an environment of mutual suspicion and surveillance is extremely troubling. Even if the indicators were right and correct and born out of scientific research, but unfortunately they're not. They're in fact refuted by scientific research. So it would be hard to imagine that any positive result would come out of this. And as we saw in Texas with Ahmed's clock, it's easy to imagine sinister intentions behind even the most benign activity. And when we're starting to describe suspicious communities by the ideas that they discuss rather than by any actual illegal activity, I think we're going down a very dangerous path.
It sounds like the FBI, just as it wants to find a back door into certain Apple devices, is trying to find a political back door to do its political spying.
Right. There are very important discussions we need to have. I mean, if you look at the presidential campaign, if you look at our foreign policy and the wars we're engaged in overseas, this requires the next generation to really struggle with some very difficult concepts. And a program like this, where students know that teachers are monitoring their online behavior, that they're questioning their examination of ideas that aren't completely within the orthodoxy of the teacher's viewpoint, will only suppress those discussions. And what our country is built on is the recognition that bad speech is countered by more speech, and we have to protect all kinds of speech and to ensure that new ideas that can move us forward in a positive direction as a nation can be articulated, even at a time like during Martin Luther King's era, where the status quo was not accepting of that type of discussion. And the last thing we want is return to an era where the FBI is actively subverting those discussions.
That was Michael German of the Brennan Center for Justice.
In Inglewood, California, community members protested yet another police killing. 31-year-old Keisha Michael, a mother of three sons, and 32-year-old Markintan Sandlin, a father of four daughters, were shot dead by a police SWAT team, apparently while they were asleep in a car. Keith Jackson is an organizer with the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. He assisted the victims' families in organizing this weekend's protest.
Well, at this point, what we know is that Keisha Michael and Markintan Sandlin were in a car at 3 a.m. It was Sunday night going on to Monday at 3 a.m. on the 22nd of February. And apparently, Inglewood cops came up on them. They were asleep in the car, and 45 minutes later, they were gunned down by automatic gunfire. And, you know, we just had a report here in the LA Times where it said 1,300 police shootings in Southern California since 2000, and not one indictment of a cop, not one prosecution. And, of course, this is going on throughout the country. There's a whole epidemic of murder by police, including in the face of protests that have been going on, especially since Ferguson. Protests the likes we have not seen in many, many years, many decades, really. But in the face of that, there's been a doubling down in police departments throughout the country have continued to kill people, tase them to death, beat them to death, shoot them to death. And this is another one of those situations here in Inglewood that it needs to be fought. There's not a lot of information that's come from the police department. You know, what I understand is that police came up on them when they were in their car. They're saying that she had a gun in her right hand. They're also saying that they were asleep. They apparently did call Special Weapons and Tactics and put together a military-style operation. And 45 minutes later, they were dead. And no doubt shot multiple times, but even there, we don't even know. You know, and the family doesn't know the actual how many times they were shot or anything like that.
The police say that they were threatened by the unconscious couple. They used a megaphone and then ultimately opened fire. It seems that they were shot because they failed to wake up.
Yeah, and that they're black. And I say that because this is racially targeted throughout the country, black and brown people. This is really like a genocidal onslaught. This is really a genocidal rampage, and I'm not using that any hype reasons or anything like that. I mean, they have murdered 1,136 people in 2015 at a time when people have been taking the stage and saying this has got to stop, doubling down, saying, no, we're going to continue to kill black and brown people especially. People throughout the country have really, you know, we've really got to continue to stand up and actually take things to the whole, to the next level. I mean, campuses should be roiling on a question like this. And I know there are a lot of campuses throughout the United States where there have been protests against institutional racism on campus, and that's extraordinarily important. At the same time, we've got this, you know, happening, murder by police, mass incarceration happening out of society. You know, the whole question of which side are you on, people? You know, are you on the side of the police and the system that's unleashing the police, or are you on the side of people who are standing up against this, the families and thousands of other and really millions of other people who want to see this stop? That's got to be a big dividing line in society.
Keith Jackson of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network.
Virginia Sewell is the aunt of Keisha Michael, the mother of three who was killed by the Inglewood, California police. Ms. Sewell says the community is outraged.
Keisha was asleep. Both of them were asleep. If they're asleep, what harm could they do? The number of bullet shells casing that we found at the scene speaks for itself, that there were multiple rounds. They didn't have a chance. I see the police killing. The majority of them end up getting off with pay. You know, we don't know who the cops are. We haven't seen them. We haven't heard nothing of it. And if we don't take a stand now, we never will. We'll go ahead and we'll wait, and we'll throw this under the cover. But no, we got to keep traveling. We got to keep traveling. We can't stop now. There's no stopping us now.
What do you want to happen with this case?
I want justice to be served. I really do, that these police will need to come forward and then tell the truth about what happened. I can't in no way, form, or fashion believe that they were a threat to society while they're over on the side of the road sleeping. Because if they get away with this here, they say, okay, give them another 2 months, we'll go out there and kill us another couple of us. Because they seem like they're enjoying it. And then it makes me feel really threatened because they seem as though they're laughing about it.
That was Virginia Sewell speaking from Inglewood, California.
Donald Trump has caused sheer panic among establishment Republicans, many of whom claim they'll leave the party if Trump wins the presidential nomination. But how should the black left view the Trump campaign? We asked Dr. Anthony Monteiro, a member of the Black Radical Organizing Committee, which put together a conference on the black radical tradition in Philadelphia back in January. Monteiro says both political parties are in trouble, and Trump's rise is just a symptom of the crisis.
It is a phenomenon, and it has to be treated as a social and political phenomenon, where this figure, who is an absurdist, clownish figure, is upsetting the apple cart of the Republican Party establishment and is really on his way to winning the nomination, and in some ways has to be considered competitive, if not the head-on favorite, to win the presidency. The question is, what does this phenomenon manifest, and what is giving it, as it were, legs? And I would say it is connected to the objective fact of a system, an economic, social system in crisis and in some ways in meltdown, and the subjective response of white people, in particular, the white working class, lower middle class, and poor, to the fact that they are now in a hole out of which they will not emerge. That looking forward, there is no possibility of their recovery from this now 10 years, practically, of economic recession, and it looks like they will remain in that state. Now, if I might just say, who are these white folks? These are white people who were brought into the Republican Party, some people say seduced into the Republican Party, by Nixon's Southern strategy, which was a code word for a white strategy, and the Reagan Revolution, which was a further extension and a more sophisticated form of the Southern strategy, that a political party could be built and was built and took power in the presidency, in the House, in the Senate, and in state legislatures across the country based upon one ideological position, and that is white supremacy. And now, with the systemic crisis, which is both a crisis of the economic system and a crisis of the system of white supremacy, these working class Republicans and these lower middle class Republicans are now in an existential crisis. And the Trump phenomenon is a manifestation of this crisis.
Ronald Reagan kicked off his presidential campaign in Philadelphia, Mississippi. That was certainly a signal that was louder than a dog whistle. How is Trump so different from that?
Well, and this is the great irony of it. Obviously, the contours of this Trump movement are shaped by the past history of the Republican Party since Nixon. Therefore, it is a rebellion within the framework of white supremacy. It is a rebellion against, without a positive direction. So it is against the Republican Party establishment, who these existentially troubled white folk are saying betrayed us. You told us that if we went with you, if we went with open and subtle white supremacy, white people would be and could be saved from the ravages and contradictions of capitalism. That all of that negative stuff would fall upon especially black people who deserved it, as the narrative had it. Now they are feeling the harshness of austerity and war and financialization and neoliberalization. They are on the verge of losing everything. Over half of the American working population makes $30,000 a year or below. White, middle-aged men with a high school education or lower are the only demographic in the American population to have seen a decline in their life expectancy since the year 2000. On top of that, you have this growing sense of betrayal, and you put all of that together, you have this rebellion. It is a rebellion against rather than a rebellion for. There is no positive side of it. So therefore, they don't want to hear anything that, for example, the Mitt Romneys and the Jeb Bushes or any of these white men in suits who claim to have represented them. They want to bring the whole thing down, and they are bringing it down. And in so doing, they are part of the reshaping of the American political landscape. Where this will end up is hard to say. A lot depends upon two factors. One, when and how black people enter what is a rebellion on both sides of the two-party duopoly, because you have the Bernie Sanders movement on the Democratic side. How black people enter this. The second thing is how the black left is able to intervene in this whole political equation.
Well, when you speak of how black people enter this in terms of electoral politics, black voters seem to be positioned on the right-hand side of the Democratic Party.
Well, seem to be. Right now, it's hard to say because the turnout has been so low. I think it's said that about 12% was the turnout in South Carolina, which was supposed to be and was in a lot of ways the Clinton firewall. I don't know what the turnouts were in Mississippi. I would suspect very, very low because of its history, et cetera. Similarly in Alabama, probably the same thing in Georgia. Because, and the other part of that is the Sanders forces did not put up any kind of serious challenge in any of these southern states. But we will know better as we come to the big Rust Belt states like Illinois and Ohio and Pennsylvania, and to a certain extent, Maryland, which is not a Rust Belt state, and so on. I suspect that black folk are looking at these rebellions and will decide later in the electoral and primary struggle, where they will go and how they will enter this fray. That's my more positive outlook on it. I just don't think that black folk will remain, as they are at this point, neutral in these rebellions.
Donald Trump's white supporters don't seem to be attracted by the established Republican Party's talk about capital gains and austerity and its warmongering abroad. What are they interested in?
Well, see, that's the whole point. It is a rebellion against. It's hard to say what they are for. They are fed up and want to bring down the Republican Party elite and don't care if they bring the party down as a whole in the process. And they are ready to do that. If Donald Trump is prevented from getting the nomination, they think the Republican establishment thinks they have a problem on their hands now. They're going to have a real problem because a lot of these white working class and lower middle class people are so angry and so violent that anything is possible. I think the best thing for the Republican Party establishment, the Mitt Romneys and the McCains and the Bushes and on, their best thing is to let Trump get the nomination and they openly or subtly support Hillary Clinton if she is the nominee, and that's not a guarantee. So it is a rebellion against. There is no positive direction at this point. Now, this means if you look at the Bernie Sanders rebellion, what we see are the same objective forces driving it. Inequality, unemployment, low wages, austerity, and on and on and on. Both are, in essence, rebellions of white people against the traditional establishments of their parties. Now, on the Bernie Sanders side, there is a more positive program of policies, which include a kind of a New Deal remaking of a governmental policy. But objectively, the economy and economic inequality and how this is impacting white, middle class, and working class people is what is driving both rebellions. These are, in fact, rebellions of white people. Now, and that does not mean it is negative. It does mean that the political landscape is on the cusp of being radically reconfigured.
The establishment Republicans seem to have thought that they could scare Trump's supporters into backing the party by saying that Trump was destroying the party, but they don't seem to care.
No, they don't care. And, you know, the interesting thing is the Tea Party, which 6 years ago emerged as the extreme right, is now a part of the establishment and supporting, for the most part, Ted Cruz. And they're being rejected. And the interesting thing is that Trump is a chameleon. He is ill-defined in terms of his political positioning. So he supports Planned Parenthood. He calls for neutrality on the Israeli-Palestinian question. He calls George Bush a liar for taking us to war over so-called nuclear weapons in Iraq. He is critical of Hillary Clinton and the Libyan war. So you get this strange kind of person. And he says that the people that he loves most are the people with a high school education or lower. He is a leader of a rebellion, but after they, quote, take power, the questions of what you do with it are not defined.
Some people on the left want folks to react to the Trump phenomenon by calling upon everybody, all the non-Trump forces, to come together in a kind of united front against what they say is the threat of fascism.
And that is ill-advised. And I think people who are arguing that are making a great strategic and tactical mistake, because what that would do is equivalent or analogous to what happened in 2008, that the left becomes the handmaiden and the ground troops for the liberals, whatever that means. And of course, in their equation, we have no option but to support Hillary Clinton, the quote, liberal, when in fact, on multiple issues, Trump and Hillary are either the same or Trump is to the left of Hillary. On war and peace, Hillary is the most dangerous candidate in either party running for office. So this is a very wrong-headed way of looking at it. Now, of course, in saying that, we can never take off the table the threat of fascism and of war. But they do not and will not come in the manner that many people think they will come. I am of the opinion that Trump does not represent a greater threat to democracy and to global peace than Hillary Clinton does. I think she represents the greater threat. So therefore, this idea that we have to unite behind the, again, with quotes around it, liberal Hillary Clinton against the fascist Trump has it wrong. What I think the proper strategy for the left and progressive forces should be is that we have to enter the fray of this rebellion and hopefully dig in for the long struggle that will go beyond November and beyond the presidential election. But the rebellion that is creating this chaos in the political system will continue, I believe. And at least the issues producing it are not going to go away because of the election. The left has to dig in, has to establish organic relationships, and the black left, especially with black folk, and begin to shape and give guidance to what is going to be a rebellion that will include black people, as well as whites and Latinos and others.
Yes, when we examine the political scene, Hillary Clinton has much more in common with those establishment Republicans on issues of war and peace and the economy than with Donald Trump.
I would agree with you. And again, we have to say, don't think that Hillary has won the Democratic primary. There's still a lot of time. Now, I'm not saying that even if Bernie Sanders becomes a Democratic presidential candidate, that we should fold up our tents. No, this is but an opportunity to dig in, to make greater political and ideological commitments to building movements based upon economic and foreign policy and police state issues. And that's the path forward. We cannot make the mistake that the left, the black left in particular, made in 2008 and throw all of our weight uncritically behind Barack Obama as the so-called liberal option. There is, in my estimate, no, and I put quotes again, liberal option in the political presidential context right now. What we're looking at is the left option. And by left, I'm talking about left broadly defined, including the social democratic left, the socialist left, the anti-imperialist left, and what some like to call the hard left. But the left options are the only positive ones in this objective situation.
One would wish that Bernie Sanders supporters were as uncaring about the fortunes of the Democratic Party as Donald Trump supporters are about the fortunes of the Republican Party.
Yeah, that's true. And see, here is the difference. Bernie Sanders comes from within the Democratic Party. Most of his supporters and followers come from within the Democratic Party. They want, in essence, most of them, to reform the Democratic Party. On the other side, the Trump forces are Republicans, evangelicals, but also independents, and Democrats who identify with this white crisis of both economic and racial dimension. On the other side, Bernie's forces are not as angry as the Trump forces. However, I think the potentiality for them to grow in their anger and dislike and distrust of the Clinton forces, those possibilities exist as we go forward, because Clinton and them are just going to get more vicious as they are more challenged, as the challenge becomes stiffer.
So there is still the possibility of a fracture within the Democrats as well.
Yes, definitely, definitely. And I think we will know better when we get to those states that are blue states, or the states that the Democrats have to win in order to win the presidencies. And those are the big Rust Belt or formerly industrial states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Illinois, to a certain extent Wisconsin, and then the big states like New York and California. That's where it's going to get nasty. The Republican primaries have been essentially, or for the most part, in states that Republicans win, the South and the lower Midwest states. So it's a different dimension in terms of the timetable of primaries. Once you hit these states like the Rust Belt states, the former industrial states, and so on, it can get very serious in the Democratic Party, because that's when the real fight should break out.
Dr. Anthony Montero, speaking from Philadelphia.
This month marks the 15th anniversary of the historic United Nations Conference Against Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance in Durban, South Africa. Bar editor and columnist Ajamu Baraka, a founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network, attended the Durban conference back in 2001. Later this month, Baraka will be in the Netherlands to lead a panel discussion on the Durban process.
It is both a commemoration and a review. There are a number of Africans who are coming in from around the world, literally, to engage in this review of the Durban process, specifically looking at the Durban Declaration and Program of Action as the defining document that came out of the Durban process, the document that theoretically was supposed to be the point of legitimacy and guidance for how states were supposed to begin to deal with the issues of white supremacy, race, xenophobia, in their respective countries. But of course, we know that the Durban process was assaulted and that attention was then diverted away from that process as a consequence of both the attack in New York that took place literally a couple of days after the conference, and then the systematic efforts on the part of the administrations, both the Republicans and the Democratic administration under Barack Obama, to undermine, marginalize, and make ineffective the Durban process and that very important Durban Declaration and Program of Action.
Yes, what you call an assault on the Durban process occurred in 2001 by President Bush and then again by President Obama. But what did they do to undermine the process, both of them?
Well, first, of course, we know and remember that the U.S. was, in essence, opposed to the process, especially when it became clear that that Durban process was raising some very uncomfortable political positions. In fact, one of the things that was raised and became a defining moment in the Durban process, and when we're talking about the Durban process, we're not just talking about the conference, but all of the work that we were involved in leading up to Durban. And one of the things that came out in terms of an analysis and a consensus around was the fact that we said that Europe was literally a creation of Africa and the Americas. That is, that the hegemony of Europe was a consequence of the invasion of the Americas, the subjugation and attempted extermination of native people, and the importation and exploitation of African labor. that became the foundation for European, quote-unquote, civilization and capitalism. So the dichotomy between the so-called North and the South had a material basis, and we said that the material basis was, in fact, the transatlantic slave trade, and that was part of the consensus that we came up with. And that was the basis of then the demand for reparations. And that reparations, in terms of how it gets defined in the U.S. with us getting a little piece of money or whatever, but reparations also in terms of the relationship between the states in the North and the various states in the Africa diaspora, both in the Caribbean and on the African continent. So because of those kinds of issues that were raised, there was an assault and a walkout by the U.S. delegation. We know that the propaganda arm of the Israelis went into high gear to try to frame the gathering as some type of anti-Israel gathering, and they were largely successful with that. And that assault, that ideological and political assault, continued subsequent to those years and even intensified under our first black president when we had the Durban Review in 2009. In 2009, the Obama administration did everything in its power to undermine that process. Even after significant concessions were made by the various UN bodies to try to address some of the issues that the administration had, even after those concessions were made and it was apparent that there should be no more legitimate opposition from the U.S. state, they still decided to boycott the process, and they did that and provide a political cover for all of the European states, and in particular the European settler states, who also walked out and undermined the Durban Review back in 2009.
And by settler states, you include the United States. When you talk about Europe as we know it and capitalism as it came to be, as being the product of slavery and plunder, the U.S. doesn't have that exceptionalist argument, does it?
No, and those of us who know history, who understand the evolution of what became the West, we understand that there's nothing exceptional in plunder and rape and exploitation and brutality. That is the weapon that was used to both to create Europe and the U.S., and it's the weapon that's being used today in their desperate attempt to maintain their hegemony. So the ideological weapon or tactic of this sort of so-called American exceptionalism has no basis in reality at all. It's merely a device to confuse and to justify their attempts to try to maintain their dominance and to ignore international law and international morality.
Are Europe and the United States still presenting that brick wall when it comes to reparations, broadly put?
Well, they are. I mean, there's less effort being expended at this point because they've been fairly successful in marginalizing the conversation coming out of the Durban process. After the U.S. helped to undermine the review in 2009, there were still attempts by various states, in particular the African group and various African descended organizations, to keep Durban and the Durban process alive. And we have been very successful in getting the U.N. to declare an international year of people of African descent. And then that was then created the international decade for people of African descent. So very important move, but we know that within the UN, though, still the organizations, the structures that are primarily responsible for monitoring and shepherding through the process, the Durban process, and the ideals around the decade, we know that they have been marginalized, underfunded, and so therefore the European states can basically just sort of ignore the process at this point. So that's why we're having the roundtable. The roundtable is one of the efforts that we are trying to engage in to try to revitalize the movement and to keep pressure, but also to educate people on the existence of this Durban process and declaration and program of action, and to hopefully so people can understand that there are elements of that document they can use in their advocacy and organizing work, especially at this moment in history when we see the kind of sharpening of the racial contradictions throughout the Western world.
There have been some initiatives from the Caribbean countries regarding reparations, but that's outside of the Durban framework, isn't it?
Well, actually, no. It was motivated by the Durban process. And many of these states are very much aware of and have embraced the Durban program of action. So they, in fact, sort of continued the demand that came out of the Durban process. So I'm glad you raised that question, because that is a corrective that we probably need to make. I mean, they've been raising some very serious questions and making some serious demands. And those demands are reflective of the kind of demands that we wanted to raise in Durban, but which got somewhat short-circuited. So no, this is all part of that process. And in fact, we expect to have a number of representatives from the Caribbean at the roundtable in a couple of weeks.
In the Netherlands, you'll be doing a panel on escalating global racism. Is racism escalating globally?
Well, of course it is. When we talk about globally, we have to, you know, sort of center this in the Western world, in the sense that that's where you see the sharpest examples of racialized contradictions. The whole conversations around what is happening in Europe, for example, with the influx of migrants from North Africa and the so-called Middle East, a conversation and a pushback on the part of European people that have been taking place for the last few years, but only really just intensified with the influx of folks from Syria. And with the rise of these various right-wing parties in which immigration and racism has been at the center of their political platforms, we see a very serious development. And then when you connect that to what is unfolding in the U.S., not just with the Donald Trump phenomenon, which is the most dramatic expressions of the right-wing racist politics that have been in place for quite some time, you have to trace this back. We can go all the way back. But in terms of the rise of the so-called new right beginning in the 1980s, we see that this rightist orientation, this rightist trajectory, is only just at this moment in history becoming more sharp. But race, white supremacy, has been a major element of the U.S. experience. And in the context of this economic crisis and the impact it's having on the so-called middle class and, in particular, white workers, with no explanation given to what is happening to them, then it's inevitable that we have a neo-fascist explanation being provided by someone like a Donald Trump, who represents a certain class perspective, who is now building a class coalition with white workers and the lower middle class, so that we have the class component, the class foundation for a unique U.S.-based neo-fascist movement. And so the fascism in the U.S. and the rise of the fascist groups in Western Europe are part of, or really two sides of the same coin, driven by these economic contradictions and rested on the foundation of the defense of white supremacy, which provides for them a political platform for a cross-class racial coalition.
For 500 years, the Europeans have planted their flag and worked their will and plundered and enslaved most of the rest of the world, and yet now they're walling themselves off, and Donald Trump talks about his wall that he says Mexico ought to pay for.
Exactly, and the walling is both literal and figurative. That basically, the walling is also the psychological, in the sense that the message of Donald Trump and others is that if the white world intends to maintain its hegemony, its dominance, that it has to be more expressive in its white racial consciousness and be prepared to fight for hegemony. I mean, that is part of the motivation we see with the aggressive military interventions across the planet, and in particular in the so-called Middle East, that these folks are prepared to fight now militarily and openly and in extra legal ways to maintain their hegemony. That's why democracy is no longer an effective tool. They had to abandon that. International law, now basically a constraint. And so that has to be jettisoned. So these folks are willing to fight and are fighting to the death. And that fight, Brother Glenn, is going to manifest itself in the U.S. in such a way where basically as it begins to deteriorate in Europe and around the world, the fight of the bourgeoisie, the white bourgeoisie, that last fight will take place in the U.S. It's going to be the last bastion of white supremacy. And our people have got to understand that and start preparing for that. If not, then we're in for a terrible situation. It's going to be terrible anyway, because there's going to be a neo-fascist phase. But we've got to understand that we are, in fact, at war. And that is part of the message that I'm bringing to this conference in the Netherlands, that this is not about just sitting around tables and talking about declarations, but we're not preparing for war, but basically we are preparing to be the victims of genocide.
Well, certainly the police have been on a war footing in our communities for almost ever, but Donald Trump seems to be verbalizing, vocalizing that kind of war path.
Exactly, and the response from our side has not been adequate. We're not effectively making the connection between the escalation of state violence and what that means politically in terms of the commitment on the part of the 1%, the capitalist oligarchy, to maintain its power, and that the state is the instrument that is used to control us, and the coercive institutions, including the police forces and the prisons and all of these other structures, are the tools that they use to maintain their hegemony and to undermine our desire for freedom. So these kinds of political connections have to be made. And that's why we have to understand and make the connection between what is happening politically, domestically, and what is happening internationally. That's why it's impossible for us as African people to just look at a Bernie Sanders campaign and platform just in terms of domestic politics and completely dismiss the fact that he's still largely supporting U.S. pro-imperialist policies that undermine the dignity and the worth of people's lives who are non-European around the world. We can't do that. Our internationalism in terms of principles and our understanding of what we're up against, we've got to make those connections to understand that we are up against one global structure, and we can't solve our problems in the U.S. without the international system being fundamentally transformed.
And so we hear all these rhetorical racist flourishes from Trump, but the same wars being waged by establishment Republicans and so-called liberal Democrats and socialists and social Democrats, as they call themselves, in Europe.
Exactly. And the commitment is basically to maintain the hegemony of the West and the capitalist system. So there's not much space between the more dramatic articulations of that position by a Trump and a Le Pen in France and that of a Hillary Clinton or even a Bernie Sanders in some ways. That basically, if we're not talking about a serious examination of the structures of white supremacy, which is founded on capitalism and is driven by capitalism and imperialism, if we're not talking about understanding that that system has to be dismantled, then basically we are doing a disservice to not only African people, but to people around the world who understand that connection and who are involved in struggle. But their struggles are being assaulted, being attacked, undermined by the U.S. and by Western Europe. So solidarity and pure reason demands that those kinds of connections are made.
You're a founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network. You've been doing this kind of work for decades. Do you find that young activists these days are speaking your language?
The human rights language has seeped through, but what I'm advocating is what we call a people-centered conception of human rights. And that is a decolonial approach to the concept of human rights. For us, human rights is a political project. It is part of the agenda to shift power to the people, to undermine the structures that deny human dignity, that undermine human freedom. So for us, the people-centered human rights is a movement that is about radical, fundamental change. So we are trying to get that message across, that it's important to raise certain issues in international arenas, but we have to understand that ultimately, if we're not building power, if we're not committed to undermining the structures that undermine our human rights, then basically all we're doing is perpetuating a fraud and undermining our ability to build the kind of movement that we have to build if we're really committed to human rights. So that understanding we are trying to get across to folks, we believe that a people-centered framework can be a framework that can be used politically, and so we're going to try to push that out, especially during the rest of this year.
So incantations against racism without work in the service of self-determination is just empty.
It really is. And our commitment to people-centered human rights is a commitment to democracy, social justice, and self-determination. We recognize, again, that there are structures of oppression that have to be dismantled. So if you're not talking about dismantling those structures, then basically you are pushing a program of reform that is only meant to confuse people and to perpetuate the structural relationships that we are all experiencing today. So we say we have got to make a break. There has to be a rupture with the system, a rupture with its dominant ideals, and we believe that pushing the notion of people-centered human rights allows us to facilitate that ideological rupture with the dominant ideology.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.